From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Jackie Lydon. Tropical Storm Hanna is drenching much of the eastern seaboard today. The wind and rains have eased considerably since Hanna lashed the Caribbean island nations of Haiti and the Dominican Republic earlier this week. More than 150 people were killed in Haiti, where floodwaters remain and relief efforts are underway to help people in isolated towns and villages. NPR's Jason Beaubien is on the line now from the hard-hit city of Gonaïves, Haiti. Jason, what's it like there in Gonaïves?
Well, at the moment, I'm halfway up to my knees in water. We've still got about a foot of water in the streets, and that's in the best of places. And this water is completely brown. There's mud everywhere. I mean, just around me right now, there's some people on the roof just across from me, some children, the entire family's up on the roof. I mean, all of these buildings have been shattered in a city that's an incredibly poor city in an incredibly poor country. And now these buildings have been just completely slammed by the floods from Hurricane Hanna.
So how are people holding up? This is their second hurricane in just over a week. They're also pretty hard hit by Gustav.
They were hard hit by Gustav, then it was Tropical Storm Hanna, and we've got Ike off the coast. People are incredibly nervous here. Some people are actually leaving at this point, trying to get up to higher ground. People have been without any food or water for quite a few days because all road access into here was cut off. And the waters came through, you know, at a second-story level, so they just wiped out everything. There's nothing left in any of the stores. So people are sort of really hanging on. As I've been standing here, people have been coming up to me asking for food, asking for water. A lot of people are desperate.
Is Gonaïves particularly low-lying?
It is particularly low-lying. There are sort of mountains that surround it, and it's a port city, so the water just came rushing off of the surrounding area and barreled right through here. It also did that in 2004 when Hurricane Jeanne, it hit here and also did similar damage, and it took them years. They were still trying to recover from that. It's a fairly dire situation.
How would you rate the relief effort going on there, Jason? I'm presuming there is one. I mean, we can hear that people are coming up and asking you for food and water. Are they getting that sort of thing?
People are getting some food and water. It's still very touch and go because they don't have any road access. The UN is flying everything in here in helicopters. They also brought in one boat, but things are still quite dire in terms of the needs of people. Things are not going incredibly well in terms of the relief effort, although there's been a real effort to get as much food and clean water in here as possible.
And where is Hurricane Ike now relative to Haiti?
Hurricane Ike is off the north shore, and the UN base, which is providing all of the relief operation, is actually under an evacuation at the moment, and they're taking out all non-essential personnel because they're afraid that this area is going to get slammed again by not directly by Hurricane Ike, but by some of the outer bands of rain. And with the hills so saturated already, people are worried that even a light rain could end up causing more flooding here in Gonaïves.
NPR's Jason Beaubien in Gonaïves, Haiti. Thank you very much, Jason.
You're welcome.
From Edward G. Robinson to Scarface to The Sopranos, the life of a mobster is a Hollywood staple. But in real life, few gang leaders actually tell their stories. The code of silence, omerta, in the Italian mafia, runs deep, and breaking that code can be fatal. Today and tomorrow, we'll profile one gangster who has broken that code. His name, Rene Enriquez. Nicknamed Boxer, he rose to the top of the Mexican mafia. That's a vicious gang born inside California's prison system. Rene Enriquez killed for the gang and ordered deaths in prison and on the streets of L.A. Then he changed the course of his life. Michael Montgomery of American Radio Works spent 2 years following Enriquez and has the story.
In the unlikely event you encountered Rene Enriquez on the street, you'd meet a polite man with a tinge of cockiness, perhaps that of a high-powered business executive or professional athlete. But if you met up with Enriquez, say on the beach, with his shirt off, you'd have a very different impression. Carved on his body are menacing tattoos that tell a life story of mayhem and murder.
I think the most prominent tattoo I have is the black hand on my chest. It's a symbol of the Mexican mafia. We call it the black hand of death. I'm not hard to look at. I look like a typical gang member. But I don't believe I'm a typical gang member. I believe I'm a cut above the rest. as a mafioso, you have to be an elitist. You have an elitist, arrogant mentality. That's how you carry yourself in the Mexican mafia. That's how you project yourself. I mean, you walk into a room and everybody knows you're a leader.
The reason you probably won't be meeting Enriquez is that he's behind bars, serving two life sentences for murder. California prison is where Enriquez fought his way to the top of the Mexican mafia, a group that rallies Latino gang members from the southern part of the state. Then he had a change of heart.
My name is Rene Enriquez. I have been involved in organized crime for 20 years, and I've been a Mexican mafia member for over 17 years.
Enriquez quit the Mexican mafia and agreed to cooperate with authorities. He told his story to prison investigators in videotaped interviews like this one.
I made a list of all the murders that I was aware of, and there are over 70 murders that I was aware of, and I'm positive I'm forgetting a couple dozen.
Rene Enriquez became the highest-level Mexican mafia leader to work with the cops. Robert Marquez is a special agent with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation.
For the first time, we had a Mexican mafia member defect that was really able to lay out for us how the organization works, the organizational structure.
Enriquez's information was a bonanza, but what really intrigued investigators was his unusual profile. Enriquez grew up in a middle-class home in places like Thousand Oaks and Sunset Hills. He showed early promise in school, but instead of following his father into business, Enriquez channeled his ambitions into the local street gang.
And once we got in the gangs, we understood that the homeboys that got out of prison were well-respected. You go there and you learn prison. So we all wanted to go there. We wanted to get to prison somehow, and we were destined to get there.
While serving time for armed robbery, Enriquez started carrying out assaults for Mexican mafia leaders in San Quentin and Folsom prisons. The mafia had deep roots in the California prison system, having been formed there in the 1950s. Enriquez learned the art of making homemade knives and hiding them in his rectum. He carried out assaults for the Mexican mafia on other inmates. Then, after he was paroled, Enriquez used his connection with Mexican mafia leaders in prison to extort drug dealers on the streets.
You shake down other crooks, what are they going to do? Go to the police? No. So they're an easy target.
Chris Blatchford is a Los Angeles television reporter who's written a book about Enriquez called The Black Hand.
He was more ruthless than they were. He was greedier than they were. And he was smarter than they were. And he really lived off the booty he took from crooks.
This is Rene Enriquez, nicknamed Boxer. Gang sources tell Channel 2 Boxer Enriquez came out of Folsom Prison in late 1989 with Mexican mafia orders to kill.
When a drug dealer refused to pay up, Enriquez retaliated.
In this East L.A. neighborhood dominated by a street gang called White Fence, Boxer's target was David Gallegos, a renegade Mexican mafia member who was not kicking back money or drugs to his mafia brothers. Boxer allegedly put five bullets in Gallegos' head, execution style.
Enriquez was finally arrested. Prosecutors wanted the death penalty, but they settled on two life sentences after Enriquez agreed to plead guilty. In 1993, the state sent him to Pelican Bay State Prison on California's remote north coast. Because he was a member of a prison gang, Enriquez was locked in a windowless isolation cell in the Security Housing Unit, or SHU. There, inmates spend 24 hours a day alone without seeing the outside world, except on television.
I just want to write and tell you about Pelican Bay.
Many years later, Enriquez started capturing his life story in audio tapes he recorded off the cuff for families and friends. He says he got the idea from a movie. In this tape, Enriquez describes his arrival to Pelican Bay's SHU.
What impacts me immediately as soon as I walk in is the smell. I just stepped outside from the bus, and you smell the pines, the redwoods, the forest, these earthy, loamy smells. But as soon as you step into the SHU, it hits you like a wave. It's the smell of despair, depression, desperation. This is a place where people come to die.
Pelican Bay was designed to break the gangs, but locked down in isolation, Enriquez and his cohort remained defiant. They concocted simple but effective communication networks. They passed messages through visitors and legal mail, mail that guards aren't allowed to read. They taught themselves exotic dialects and American Sign Language to fool prison staff, and they thrived in a culture of impunity.
That's why we took pride in not breaking. We took pride in saying, you know what, I'm going to die here, and this is my home.
He was probably the most articulate individual I've ever met in the prison system, and very charismatic.
Special Agent Robert Marquez was Pelican Bay's chief gang investigator. He eventually learned a secret to Enriquez's success, transforming punishing isolation into a sort of sanctuary. Rival gangs couldn't get to him, and most cops and prosecutors thought their job was already done. After all, Enriquez was serving two life sentences. The prison couldn't do much more to punish him. But lifers have time to think and scheme.
We had a thing called 1,000 Concepts. A few of us did up in Pelican Bay. We'd spin off 1,000 ideas, and if only one of them was profitable, we were succeeding. So we'd do this every day up in Pelican Bay, 1,000 miles from our base of power, spinning off ideas that paid money.
Enriquez treated the street drug dealers like owners of a fast food franchise. They could use the Mexican mafia name in return for part of their profits, and they were intimidated into paying. Robert Marquez.
A street gang, Southern Hispanic or a Sureño, knows that if he's engaged in criminal activity on the streets, at some point he's going to go to jail or going to go to prison. Well, because the Mexican mafia has such influence within the prisons and the jails, that street gang member knows if I don't do what I'm told to do on the streets, that when I hit the jail or when I hit the prisons, there are those who are so loyal to the Mexican mafia that they're going to assault me.
Perhaps Enriquez's greatest achievement was in helping extend the Mexican mafia's brand to dozens of L.A. street gangs. And he did this through an elaborate subterfuge.
The Mexican mafia have called gang members to meetings like this one. The message always the same. Kill a fellow Hispanic gang member and you die.
In the mid-1990s, the group put out calls to stop drive-by shootings among L.A. Latinos, which were plaguing the city. But Enriquez says the aim wasn't peace.
Our true motivation for stopping the drive-bys was to infiltrate the street gangs and place representatives in each gang.
He says the Mexican mafia wanted to channel the random shootings into a form of violence it could control for profit.
And we already had it planned out that California would be divvied up, much like a pie is carved up into slices, with each respective member receiving an organizational turf.
The Mexican mafia's campaign against drive-by shootings had another benefit. Chris Blatchford.
Rene and his cohorts at the time felt, if we can get Latino kids to stop shooting each other, we'll really look like good people in the eyes of sympathetic city leaders, sympathetic church leaders, sympathetic do-gooders. We're going to really do a good thing here.
And for the most part, this occurred. Tens of thousands of gang members adhered to what we said. Us, high school dropouts, some of the guys illiterate. But we had such authority behind who we were. They listened. And it was then that we realized the true potential of the Mexican mafia. We can make astronomical amounts of money without ever having to touch drugs or do anything again ourselves. We could do all this. We could become a true powerhouse because of the finances generated by taxation. Taxation, extortion, protection, they all fall under the same umbrella.
Drug profits flowed to prison. Drug dealers on the street sent checks and money orders to gang leaders behind bars under the noses of California prison staff. Enriquez and his associates socked away tens of thousands of dollars. He even invested in bank CDs and government bonds. The accounts were only frozen after his defection. But success fueled greed and paranoia. Violent feuds erupted among Mexican mafia members. Some started plotting to kill the families of rivals in the gang.
This arbitrary targeting of families because I am your adversary takes it to a whole different realm of violence. This was not part of the bargain. This is not the Mexican mafia that I joined.
Rene Enriquez grew disillusioned, and he was being ground down by a heroin addiction and prison isolation, as he recalls in this audio letter to a friend.
Hopelessness. It surrounds you and envelopes you like a mist, like you're walking in an open field in the early morning, and the cool mist hits you, the dew. This is how it feels in Shu. The sense of despair and desperation there is omnipresent. I've seen individuals that I've known, strong warriors, in a sense that we consider ourselves warriors, just degrade, stand around the cell naked, yelling, screaming, babbling. I've noticed the effects of myself. I remember the first time I had an anxiety attack. I felt like I was going to die, impending doom. And that was the first sign I had that something was going wrong with me, that it was time for me to get out of this.
Enriquez was a mobster facing a midlife crisis. Robert Marquez.
In Rene's case, he had accomplished everything that he wanted to accomplish as far as being a Mexican Mafia member. However, I think in his case, he finally saw that, hey, you know what, I've reached the pinnacle of everything that I'm doing here, and yet at the same time, I'm still locked up, and is this the rest of my life? Being in this concrete cell, this concrete unit, and is this how I'm going to end my life?
They're called mob fatigue. Everybody goes through it.
He thought about dropping out, but doing so would violate his lifetime commitment to the gang.
You've taken 20 years of your life to create the persona that you are. I mean, this is your image. This is who you are. So in a sense, it's like committing suicide.
He finally took the plunge. In 2002, Enriquez left the Mexican Mafia. His defection put him on the gang's hit list, but it also opened a new universe. After leaving the prison isolation unit, Enriquez saw the night sky, the moon and stars, for the first time in 10 years. Today, he says he has many regrets, but as he looks back, he still marvels at how a group of high school dropouts managed to turn the criminal justice system upside down.
I was rather proud of being a Mexican Mafia member. I did things in the organization that some people had never done. We pushed this towards being a financial success. We started thinking about intellectual progress, business progress, infiltration of society. And I know this sounds so deviant to the listeners. I mean, it just sounds, this guy is talking about the creation of an organized crime group, and he's proud of it. But that was my life. It was who I was.
Those days are in the past, says Enriquez. He has a new life now, a life in which his former enemies, the cops, are his protectors and even his friends. For NPR News and American Radio Works, I'm Michael Montgomery.
Tomorrow, Michael Montgomery explores the new life of Rene Enriquez, still behind bars, but now working against the gang he once led. Michael's stories come from American Radio Works, the documentary unit of American Public Media, and you can see a video of Enriquez revealing secrets of the Mexican Mafia on our website, npr.org. This is NPR News.